Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome to Soundbites. We, as I said, are going to talk about raising fish in the city in our first segment here, then talk to Tom Philpott from Mother Jones Magazine about McDonald's and look at a gazpacho recipe, and end up with Charles Wright, who is owner of Wright's Market and Cornerstone Farms, a really interesting farmer in Wicomico County. Right now we're going to talk – this first segment was inspired by an article written by Van Smith for the Baltimore City Paper called The Economy of Scales. A Baltimore lab aims to take the science of growing clean, healthy seawater fish to the global marketplace. And Van's in the studio with us. Van, good to see you. It's been a
while. You
too. You're looking great. Good to have you here, man.
Thanks.
And Dr. Jonathan Zohar, Yoni, is with us. He's professor and chair of the Department of Marine Biotechnology, head of the Aquaculture Research Center Institute of Marine and Environmental Technology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore Columbus Center. Did I get all that right, Yoni?
Yeah, okay. More or less.
Okay. And the number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Before we turn to Dr. Zohar, Van, tell me about this story and what kind of drove you to it in the first place and what you were after.
Well, it was, you know, it's one of the story's genesis was a visit to Peter's Inn in Fells Point.
Peter's Pub?
Peter's Inn. Right, where and Bud came out when I was there. It's just like, we had this amazing visit from this guy from the lab at the Columbus Center, and he brought me the most beautiful rockfish I've ever seen. And I'm thinking about maybe doing something with him. I was like, wow. So it just went from there. The guy's name was Nick Hammond, and he's the, I think, assistant director at IMET. And so I contacted him, and, you know, I have a lot of other types of stories that I work on that are pressing and keeping me busy, and I finally made some room to follow through on this one, which I like science stories, and I'm a bit of a foodie. I like to cook, and, you know, it's a business story. It kind of combines a lot of different interests of mine. So,
and it really is an interesting story. I think that Jonathan Zohar, we've met a number of times over the years,
right?
And I've been down to facility twice down in Baltimore's Inner Harbor, at the old Columbus Center. And it's amazing. Let me describe my feelings about it and talk a bit about the history of it. I mean, you walk in, there's these gigantic vats full of fish and experimenting with all kinds of breeds of fish and even crabs. And last time I saw you, one of the things that popped out was that you had been actually working on how to breed crabs, which is something nobody had done before, be able to in captivity.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so you've been doing it. So talk a bit about the philosophy and the science behind what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Well, why we're doing it, it is basically responding to what is happening in the world in terms of the need for more seafood. We have more people in the world, more people eat more seafood, but also more people move from red meat into poultry and into fish or seafood just because of the health benefits associated with a seafood-based diet. As a result, we are overfishing the oceans. The ocean can give only so much, and actually we are running out of commercially imported marine fish in our oceans, and we need to develop the production of seafood in a way that it leaves the ocean resources to recover and to do it through aquaculture. Aquaculture meaning growing of the commercially imported marine fish in captivity, in tanks, in a basement, in a warehouse, as you saw. So this is the rationale behind. Now, aquaculture has been developing, you know, responding to this decline in seafood, and we know it globally, we know it locally. I mean, even in the Chesapeake Bay, less crabs, no oysters, and so on. And aquaculture has been the fastest growing agri-industry in this country and globally. Only in many cases, the practices of growing marine fish in aquaculture are not very environmentally responsible. And what we do here, we develop a land base, fully contained, fully environmentally sustainable, ecologically responsible way to grow high-value marine fish that are also very clean, healthy, and have all these great health benefits.
Now, I want to come to the clean and healthy and health benefits part and to the business part in a minute. Were you about to say something, Van? No. One of the things that you did write about, and I think that this is kind of setting up where we are with these fisheries, is reports from the United Nations about what could happen in the year 2050. And also the stuff you wrote about in other articles about that I've read about mercury and fish, and these two real dangers in terms of the future of seafood.
Yeah, I am not an expert on the global decline. I just referred to the UN reports. The state of
fish in 20.
Yeah, it's the fish.
It's the biannual report. That's the this huge summary of what fish we're taking, how much, how they're being produced.
It's an FAO, like Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN, yes.
So here, well, I'll just for our listeners to have it, one of the things in your piece was that the Food and Agricultural Organization said that more than 85% of seafood landings are of species that are either fully exploited, overexploited, or depleted, or recovering, suggesting a global system that is overstressed, reducing in biodiversity, and in imminent danger of collapse, and that by 2050, if you add to that the toxic level of mercury that's found in fish, for instance, eating 1 6-ounce portion of fish per month exceeds the EPA's human health guidelines for exposure to heavy metal. So the fate of our oceans and the fish population is very real. They were overfishing them, the fish that people love to eat, you can't get anymore. And those you do, except for a few breeds, a few species like salmon that you from the Pacific, where they're still relatively plentiful and healthy, are not healthy. And that's the danger, and that's where you started your research.
Exactly. Again, we wanted to make sure that everything that we do is number one, environmentally responsible. Many of the practices in aquaculture right now involve what we refer to as floating net pen culture in the coastal environment. And those have been criticized for having some adverse effect on the environment. Although in this country, in the United States, there is a major effort to increase their environmental responsibility and so on. And this is all good. But we wanted to bring in another practice where you grow the fish both in a way that is very environmentally sustainable. There is zero interaction with the environment, which aquaculture has been criticized for. And also there is no pollution, no contaminants, no disease, nothing else that can affect the well-being, you know, of the fish. And those are as clean, as healthy, as green as it can get. And they are very fresh as well. I mean, we grow them in the downtown Baltimore right now in the Columbus Center. And we right now, when we have extra fish, we sell them out to the local restaurants, and they love them, and they love the freshness factor about them.
And so before we come to the business part, I want you to talk a bit about what you wrote about the business part in a moment, Van, but The again describing what this future could be, because you're looking at the idea, if you expand it on the idea you're doing at the Columbus Center, of in cities in Baltimore City and cities across America, which are full of abandoned and empty warehouses and gigantic empty buildings, the idea that an urban fishing industry could be built that could actually have the possibility of sustaining people's desire for fish.
Exactly. And, you know, it will be a combination of different strategies to grow fish. But what we are doing here, instead of going into the ocean and growing fish in the ocean in a way that some people say are not very good for the environment, but I also say that net pen practices are not always good for the fish. Because of you grow salmon in Maine, the water sometimes is too cold, it's not optimal. In the warehouse, we can have those huge tanks, as you said, and the one that you saw are relatively small compared to what will be in the commercial warehouse that will be 10 times bigger and so on. We can completely tailor all the environmental conditions to allow optimal performances for the fish. They grow faster, so they make it like it really makes it more economically feasible. They grow faster. They have this freshness factor. They have the fact that they are environmentally responsible and all the above. And the idea is to grow those in, like, as Van wrote in his article, it's like almost like a cut and paste. It's also a small module that produces about 400 to 800 to 1 million pounds of fish per warehouse that you can put anywhere.
And one of the things that struck me over there, and I wanted to point out before we come back to Van Smith, is that the way you do it, as I was describing to my producers the other day as preparing for the show, was that the fish's fecal matter and all the other waste goes below the tank itself, then recycled so that fresh water is constantly coming in.
This is a very good question, and that's where the technology and the research that we do at UMBC, at the University of Maryland, comes in. The idea is to have zero waste going back to the environment while producing huge amounts of fish. How do you do it? Well, you have to convert the waste to something that is not harmful. And here is where we go to the marine biology. We go to beneficial microbes, beneficial bacteria, like the ones that we have in our guts, from the marine environment. We put them in what we refer to as biological filters. So there are microbes that live in symbiosis with the fish, and they're all beneficial, and they remove the chemical waste produced by the fish and convert it to harmless, you know, compounds that like nitrogen that goes back to the air. This is what we breathe. But also, and more importantly, there is a lot of sludge, solid waste produced, and we wanted to have zero going back to the environment. So again, we went back to the marine biology, and there is a group of microbes in the ocean that are called methanogens. As their name implies, they produce methane, biogas, and what we do, we completely convert all our solid waste produced in the facility to fuel-grade methane that is being used to offset the energy cost of the operation. So zero discharge to the environment and an added value, bioenergy, biofuel produced directly from the solid waste, from the sludge.
So business-wise, Van, I mean, this what was interesting in your article was the group you were talking about that is interested in kind of expanding this idea. I mean, I know that you and I for a long time thought this was an incredible business model you could make as a scientist to kind of expand it, but for years people just didn't get it.
Right.
They didn't get it. I mean, you had to go to China and Israel and other places for people to actually understand what the business model was to try to use, that we didn't get it here, but that's changing.
Yeah, well, two really kind of experienced business people, one lawyer, Michael Quinn, and a guy from who I think started CareFirst, David Wolf, have teamed up, and they've negotiated a license agreement with Yoni's lab. And so they will now have the license for the technology, which is, like you said, cut and paste, modular. So they're going to, once they get all their investment money lined up, they're going to go into production here in Baltimore somewhere, produce 200 tons of fish a year or more. But they're also they're predicting that it's going to go well and that the word will spread and that other people are going to want to use this technology for their markets, for their regional area, you know, so they can produce these fresh fish for the restaurants in their areas and the supermarkets in their areas, and then they will sublicense. And MSM, Maryland Sustainable Mariculture, would then help set up in, say, Nebraska, your operation, and they would get some percentage for the use of the technology. And so, you know, if it works, it's possible that you could really have fresh fish that isn't shipped or frozen, that isn't treated with any antibiotics. I mean, that's one of the things about Yoni's fish is that they're they're grown in he's closed the life cycle. So they're coming from eggs that are in his lab. They're grown in optimal conditions together as each brood comes up together. And so there's no exposure to anything else other than the pristine conditions in the lab. So there's no need for antibiotics or anything else. There's no drugs. And, you know, of course, there's no mercury content.
Right.
Which, you know, it just kind of bioaccumulates in your body. The more fish you eat, the more mercury you're going to have, which I've been aware of with having two young children. It's like you want to limit their fish. Well, maybe if we can get these fish regularly, they can eat this excellent, healthful source of protein on a regular basis without fear of mercury.
And I just want to make sure people understand those are marine fish. We are running out of the marine fish.
What do you mean by marine fish as opposed to what?
As opposed to freshwater, lake, or river fish, as opposed to carp or tilapia. We're talking about the high-value marine fish, sea bream, sea bass, in the cobia, stribus, rockfish, and in the future groupers and flounder and halibut. Those are the type of fish we are running cod, we are running out of. And these are the fish that we are bringing back. And we are growing them in seawater, but which is completely artificial. So we really don't have any contaminants from the environment either. We start with city water that goes through activated carbon. So the fish are actually, we're starting with water that is cleaner than what we drink. We make artificial seawater, simulating all the ingredients and everything, the components that have to go into seawater. And then we recycle the water using this biofiltration to remove all the waste. And the fish keep growing in completely pristine water.
So, and I know that when we first met and we talked about this, there were just a fewer varieties of fish that you were experimenting with, but clearly it's growing.
Yes.
And then each time you take a different species of fish, each time you take a different kind of fish, whether it's the rockfish or if you go to grouper or whatever, a cod, if I don't know if you started with cod or not, but each fish you have to work differently in terms of figuring out what the environment is and how to grow them It's not just as simple as saying going from an egg to throwing the fish into the vat.
Absolutely, but here's another benefit of our system. By nature of their containment, you can really tailor the environmental condition in the system to be whatever the fish need, high temperature, low temperature. So you provide optimal temperature, optimal conditions, salinity, temperature, daylight, and so on, water chemistry for every fish, really tailoring it to the requirement for optimal performances. And this is where our systems are generic. If you grow fish in floating net pens in Maine, you can grow salmon, you can grow some other cold water fish, but you cannot grow the sea bream and the bronzini and the other fish we're working with. And those fish are generic. To me, a key word to the success of aquaculture is diversification. You know, there is only one type of chicken, right? Although, you know, some people say, no, there is this chicken, that chicken.
Right. Some chicken growers would argue that there are more guys in chicken.
But anyway. In fish, you know, we have all these species that we just mentioned, and those systems are generic, and they allow you to diversify. But what you said is absolutely right. I cannot jump from one fish to another without providing the technological package. In other words, closing the life cycle, producing the eggs, growing the early life stages, and then optimizing the conditions. We're now working on bluefin tuna. You come to see me now at the Columbus Center.
Well, how big would a space would you have to grow tuna? Because they can be huge.
Well, we're working with broodstock bluefin tuna that are in the Adriatic Sea, where we're inducing them to spawn in like the northern Adriatic Sea, and the eggs, as we speak, are now being shipped to the Columbus Center, to our basement there, and we are working on opening the bottleneck in bluefin tuna aquaculture, which is the early life stages, growing the air. Nobody has been able really to do it very predictably.
And this is the part that I think is important. This is the marriage, Van. I thought about as you were writing it, and probably perhaps came to you as you were doing this story. This is the link between science and the market, science and business, science and the future. I mean, the idea that Yoni as a scientist is there with fishery biologists putting this together and kind of coming up with the systems that actually can grow fish where nobody else has grown them before, but for not just science, but actually be able to maybe have a marketplace that feeds people at a reasonable price the fish they want to eat. That, to me, is the...
Absolutely, yeah, and even rockfish. I mean, the thing about his system is that rockfish... live in different salinities and different temperatures. They travel through estuaries and
right.
fresh water to spawn. So he can simulate all of that in the conditions of the artificial seawater in his lab. And there's some tricks, I think, to getting them to actually spawn because there's
– Right.
You get into endocrinology and
– Exactly. It's as you said. It's a package. It's integrally. It's vertically integrated, right? And it goes from Mark. You know, I've been working for many years on closing life cycle, hatchery production, and so on. And you cannot have a grow out operation for fish without being able to provide the seeds, I refer to them, eggs and juveniles, on a year-round basis. And this is what we can do in our facility, and it's completely vertically integrated from the spawning stocks to the eggs to the early life stages. To growing them out to the market size.
I mean, you know, while on one side, this is a very sad commentary on the state of the Earth's environment and our waterways and our oceans. I mean, the contamination of the water, the lifeblood of the planet. This is kind of the negative side of this conversation. The other side, though, is that as we try to figure out how to ameliorate and change what we've done to the Earth.
Right.
That people have to eat, and we have to keep these species and keep the species alive to survive. Because on another level, you're also creating a system that allows endangered species to grow again. Because we could lose some of these.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the statistics. Yeah, 55% of all of our commercial fisheries are fully exploited. 30% are overexploited or depleted and so on. And this is a way to leave the wild stocks alone and to bring those fish back, you know, let them, you know, propagate and continue to feed the people through those highly nutritious and healthy fish produced through clean and environmentally responsible aquaculture completely.
I mean, you could even imagine a system like this in the United States creating a market source for market price fish in supermarkets that could actually work. Because if you're not if the if shipping, the fishing and shipping costs are not there, and this kind of new aquaculture can actually be grown in urban areas and localities. People can actually buy fresh fish that you could ordinarily not have in your own community.
And you touched on a very good point again. I mean, the whole idea of those systems can be placed anywhere. So you really reduce the carbon footprint of the operation. You can put it next to your airport, next to your markets, and reduce the carbon footprint and have them locally available. But it also goes back to the business point because, I mean, the idea of Maryland Sustainable Mariculture is to take it globally. We start in Baltimore City with one operation in a big warehouse. Imagine a warehouse of about 100,000 square feet that grow, you know, different type of fish species that we just mentioned, high-value marine fish. We start in Baltimore. We're talking about, as I said, you know, 500,000 pounds, 1 million pounds, 200 tons, 400 tons, and then you take it globally. And these are the investors that MSM, Maryland Sustainable Mariculture, are now talking to, really taking it globally.
I mean, this is also, to me, it's even though it wasn't quite in your article, I was thinking about this. I was reading your article. Was that this has to do also with jobs. I mean, this if you create urban fisheries, it becomes a kind of a new way for campuses like this to begin to train people in urban fisheries, train people as fish biologists, creating jobs of all kinds, from the people who have to keep the tanks going to the scientists who work in them. I mean, this is. I mean, what could be spawned here, no pun intended, is exciting.
Yeah,
I think there's also some less complex technology for non-marine fish to be aquacultured in a similar fashion with these filters. But then you end up with the solid waste that can be used as fertilizer for freshwater fish. If you do it with marine fish, that organic waste is filled with salt, so it would just salt your soil.
Right.
But I think that I've read that Hopkins has a project going on in Druid Hill Park with maybe tilapia.
Tilapia.
Yes, yeah. Center for a Livable Future.
Right. Because what Yoni's been developing are high-value marine fish that people are willing to pay a lot of money for. It doesn't really solve the problem for people who have limited means who want to eat fish. But there are ways to produce tilapia, for instance, that could be done in a similar fashion on also locally and also be totally fresh.
Yeah.
And then it provides the fertilizer for an urban farm. So you could
exactly.
have like, yeah.
And that's in Silburn Park, I think, where CLF is doing.
Silburn, okay.
Silburn Park,
right,
CLF
right.
is doing this work. Since people have spoken, there's been a huge growth in the work you've done.
Absolutely.
I'm curious to talk a bit more about where it's going next. What are the fish species that you're looking at next to develop?
So, yeah, the idea is to, as I said, to diversify. And when we last spoke, we were like working with a gilted sea bream, which is like the Italian orata or the French dorade royale, which is a fish that has been completely fished out. And then we optimized more on the bronzini, which is the Mediterranean sea bass. But since then, actually, we were funded by the federal government, by NOAA and by Sea Grant, to extend it to cobia. Cobia is a high-value Gulf of Mexico marine fish that was completely fished out. It's also known as lingfish. Beautiful fish fished out. We have now. We're now working on the yellow amberjack, which is also a yellowtail. The greater amberjack, which is a yellowtail, which is a very high-value fish that has completely fished out, again, Gulf of Mexico and the rest of the world. We're taking it into groupers, and now we're working on bluefin tuna. So the idea is to diversify and to provide for more fish that has been – it's not so much of the high value, although it's important for the economical feasibility. Those are fish that have been fished out and are no longer can no longer be found in the oceans.
Dr. Jonathan Zohar, good to see you again. Thank you for coming in the studio. Professor and Chair of the Department of Marine Biotechnology and Head of the Aquaculture Research Center, Institute of Marine and Environmental Technology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County's Columbus Center in downtown Baltimore. Good to have you in the studio.
Great being
great
here,
seeing
Mark.
You. And Van Smith, great to see you again. It's been a while.
You too.
Your writing has been incredible over the years. You've done some, I think, you're one of our best investigative reporters, Intrepid. This is a great article you produced for Baltimore City Paper.
Thanks
good
a
to
lot,
see you.
Man.
Thanks. Good to have you here. Here on the Mark Steiner Show, we're going to take a very brief break and come back with more on Soundbites. We're going to talk about McDonald's. Yes, your favorite place to love or your favorite place to hate. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here for Soundbites. You're listening to WEAFM 88.9 FM here in Baltimore, Maryland, Voice of the Community, and to Delmarva Public Radio on WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM in our weekly conversation about the future of our food system. I remind you on the way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late, don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait, get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. We are now joined once again by Tom Philpott, Mother Jones food and ag blogger. And Tom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Mark.
How are things going? Well?
Pretty well, thanks.
Good. So, Tom, let's start with the latest piece you wrote for Mother Jones about McDonald's to its employees. The title of your article was, your blog, Get a Second Job.
So, yeah.
What are you telling us?
Well, what's going on with McDonald's is that it's got a large number of employees across the country. It's a huge employer, and it tends to pay very low wages, minimum wage, and maybe a little bit more than minimum wage for some of the workers. But nothing approaching a minimum, a living wage. And there, about the past 6 months or so, there's a lot of organizing among fast food workers, which is great to see. People are organizing walkouts this week in seven cities across the country, not just McDonald's, but other fast food joints, Wendy's and Burger King and places like that. And apparently in response to its, increasingly aggressive workforce, McDonald's put out a sample budget to help its employees live on this wage. And it is one of the most brutally ironic documents I've ever seen. It essentially admits that you can't make ends meet working full time at McDonald's. And as part of the budget, it lists monthly income, first job, $1,100. That's how much you make in a month working 35 hours a week at McDonald's.
$1,100 a month.
Realizing that you can't live on that. There's a second line that says second job, 955 hours. So the basic message is if you want to live in the United States and pay your expenses, then you have to get a second job if you're going to work at McDonald's.
And you can barely afford to buy breakfast, lunch, and dinner at McDonald's in that salary.
Exactly. And even on this salary, basically twice the McDonald's wage, there's a lot of ridiculous things in the spending side. For example, it doesn't list anything for things like food and clothes and gasoline, which for most people in this country, you need to buy gas to get to work.
One of the things you have in the piece you wrote, which is an astounding statistic that you say came out from the Food Chain Workers Alliance, that 86% of the 20 million people who work within the food chain system in our country, that's a sixth of the overall U.S. workforce, bring home less than a living wage. Food system workers are 50% more likely to rely on food stamps. So that's something I think most Americans aren't aware of.
Yeah, I mean, basically we've got this massive army of workers feeding us. Like you said, that's 20 million people who work in the food chain and feed us. And the vast majority of them are essentially living in poverty, not poverty defined by the federal poverty rate,
yeah,
but poverty in real terms, because the federal poverty rate is way under underblown. And so you've got this, the people who feed us are struggling to put food on the table. I think it's a pretty brutal irony of our economic system.
So tell me where you did very quickly before we moved on to this recipe you've got for us. I want to talk about their move towards a healthy sandwich and why you put that in the article.
Well, I've been in a debate with a writer for The Atlantic named David Friedman, a publication called The Atlantic. And he did a kind of provocative article about a month ago saying that the answer to our obesity crisis in the United States is healthier junk food. That junk food companies like McDonald's and processed food companies that sell to the grocery store, like let's say Kraft, should simply reformulate their products, take out some of the fat and sugar, and this is going to solve the obesity crisis. And I have a lot of problems with that as a solution. And one thing I pointed out in this piece is that poverty, that that obesity and diet-related health problems are very strongly correlated to poverty. And if the food system, if these food system companies want to solve obesity, the first thing they can do is raise wages and lift some of their workers out of poverty. And I think that, you know, that would be a much more fundamental solution than putting a little bit less sugar in a McDonald's milkshake.
So is this public on this debate gone public between the two of you?
Yeah, we've gone back and forth a little bit, and we appeared in a radio show in Minnesota a couple weeks ago.
Well, I'll have to get you both on together here on this program.
That's great.
We'll do that. So let me ask you this: your other world, you also have been a farmer, and you love to cook. So tell us about this gazpacho recipe, which are my favorite things to eat on the planet.
Yeah, so I do this food column, and the whole point of the column is to try to demystify cooking and to try to show that you don't need to have, you know, lots of skills or fancy ingredients to make decent food. And I've been doing it for a few years now, this column. And this latest one, so I'm down here in Texas where it's brutally hot. And it is kind of the end of the tomato season because it's getting too hot for tomatoes even down mm-hmm. here. But we do have these beautiful ripe tomatoes coming off of farms right now. And so I was thinking, what is the easiest, most minimalist dish I can think of that isn't going to cause me to turn my stove on or turn the flame on on my oven? And gazpacho turns out to be a great light summer meal. And you know, basically all you do in this recipe is get a couple of ripe tomatoes, chop them up, throw them in the blender, get a nice cucumber, chop it up and throw it in the blender, and then some herbs and a little something hot. You know, most gazpacho recipes call for bread to thicken it up. But I wanted to keep that out, to keep it as light as possible, and maybe have bread on the side.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of them call for red bell pepper. But I wanted to even go more minimalist and just put a little hot pepper to just get a little tickle the back of your throat into it. And that's what I did. And then you just sort of finish it with some olive oil and chill it for a while, and you've got a delicious little summer soup.
Well, we're going to have this recipe on our website let you all try this. I wanted to go home and try this and pick some of the tomatoes from my garden. I don't live in West Texas, so I have plenty of tomatoes left coming.
Great.
To have more time to work on this gazpacho recipe. That sounds really good. And Tom Philpott, who joins us frequently here on Soundbites, is a Mother Jones food and ag blogger and a farmer and a writer and a general provocateur. And Tom Philpott, well, I meant that in the nicest way, Tom.
All right. Well, it's always a pleasure.
Take care, Tom Philpott. Always great to have you with us.
Take care.
Thank you. And we're going to take a very brief break. When we come back from this brief break, we're going to be joined by Charles Wright, who's owner of Wright's Market and Cornerstone Farms, a story put together in Worcester County, Wicomico County, a story put together by our producer, Mark Henry. Stay with us.
Family's been farming in Wicomico County since the 1800s. We've been at this. My grandfather bought this farm in 1949, 47, somewhere in there. And then he farmed, worked at DuPont's. He farmed about 65 acres on part-time. And then he started the produce market in about 1970 when he was off on vacation from work so he could work some more. And then my dad took it over in the late 70s, expanded it from one wagon and a card table to wagons with roofs. And then during, I guess about 2000, we built a new location. And now the farming operation consists of myself and my wife My mom still helps a little bit. She's pretty much retired. We farm about 550 acres, half, about 200 acres of vegetables. The other part's green, mainly corn. We're also in the chicken business. We grow chickens for Purdue Farms, roasters. I've got 40,000 birds, and my brother grows about 200,000 birds. We probably employ about 14 seasonal people to run the operation. We grow everything from, start off with asparagus and strawberries in the spring, and then we go to tomatoes, peppers, eggplant. Sweet corn is a bigger acreage crop. Watermelons, we grow quite a few watermelons for the market and wholesale. We also grow cantaloupes and honeydew, cassava, all the stuff for fall, like pumpkins, gourds, Indian corn, all those type of things. And then in the fall, we do ag entertainment, school kids, the hay rides, corn maize, everything that goes along with that. In the market, we sell everything we grow, the aforementioned crops, and then I buy all the fruit, anything off a tree. Peaches, we have local peaches now. We buy plums. Most of the plums are from California because that's where they're grown. You get some local ones later in the fall. And we sell cherries, blueberries, tomatoes, and we have the staples like potatoes and onions and those type of things. But we have four kinds of watermelons. I believe we have regular seedless watermelons. We got the long seeded ones. We have the sugar baby. And then we have also watermelons that are yellow inside. And then we have the cantaloupes, honeydew, canary melons. Our sweet corn is what we're known for. That's the main thing.
So could you talk a little bit about the enrichment programs you do with young farmers and your relationship with the next generation of farmers?
Okay. I'm still pretty young in my mind. But I've always been involved in young farmer program. I've kind of backed away from it now. But we still let them host their meetings at our farms. The older guys, we kind of rotate around. So if they don't have a place of their own, then come to our shops or whatever and have meetings. It's more or less serving as a soundboard for some of the younger guys that are getting started the same way. When I got started, there was two or three key gentlemen that farmed that they just helped me along. You know, even my dad, because I was doing most of the farming on the grain side at that time, my dad was alive. Just be certain questions that we didn't know. So just better off to ask somebody how to do it or what to do, and nobody else like asking somebody in your own field. So that's kind of what I've done is the younger farmers, young guys are just getting started. I try to reciprocate all that help back to them.
And I see you got some value-added products in here. Are there lots of farm stands out here selling value-added products?
I don't know if any sell quite as many as we do right here. A lot of them do. We buy like all the jellies and jams and relishes. They're value-added, but they're from somebody else's farm. We use like in our ice cream, we use our strawberries, our blueberries. Peaches we use that in there. But all the value added things for me as a marketer, it's getting something else in the cart. That's why you got a concrete floor, you get a shopping cart, little hand baskets, because if you just got hands, they fill up with a watermelon or cantaloupe and they're done shopping. But we all try to put the value added things right with them. Like we sell jarred peaches and peach preserves or peach batter right with the peaches, and then try to do a recipe, because a lot of people don't know how to cook too much. They tell you that. So if you got a recipe, it's like spaghetti squash. It's a good seller, and a lot of people hear about it or read about it. It's healthy and it's good for you, but they don't know how to fix it. So if you put a recipe with it, it's not the item, but it helps sell it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what is the state right now of Maryland land preservation, agricultural land preservation, and how are you involved with that?
Okay. We have, my wife and I have one farm in ag land preservation. We got that back in 1995, I think. Currently, that's the only farm I have. The state of land conservation in our county is zip, because they're not following, they've not done their comprehensive plan. I believe that's the right term. I've been involved in all that a couple of years ago. So really, in our county, there's no ag land preservation to speak of, because if you're not following along the steps, then they've designated the largest agriculture county in the state as non-compliant. So it kind of hurts the farmer if you're trying to get in ag land preservation. There's still a little bit of money if you're already in it, kind of grandfathered. But as far as the state goes, if they quit robbing the money, there will be money there for it. If they wouldn't regulate us to death, they wouldn't have to worry about land preservation, because if everybody's enjoying farming, making money farming, a farmer that's making money, you don't have to worry about preserving his land. He's going to take care of it. But in our state, in my opinion, we're like little California. California tries it, we do it. The regulation is a burden. I mean, just give you an example. We've got chicken houses. We've got a concentrated animal feeding operation, CAFO. So I've got that plan, which was originally initiated by MDA, enforced by MDE, and now EPA is going to be overseeing the two of them. So in my opinion, I'm paying for a lot of government jobs that one agency should certainly be able to take care of, should be the Maryland Department of Agriculture. And every citizen that's paying taxes in the state is paying the same thing. Whether you live in a state where anybody is paying, state or federal, is helping with the EPA, it's just more overreaching. And the problem most farmers feel about that is we raise our kids on the farm, we eat what we produce off the farm, we make our livelihood off the farm, and when we get accused of polluting or those type of things, nobody pollutes their own body or pollutes their land where they're going to make a living, because it would be the end of it. And all the things, all the inputs we have to use, they all cost money. And there's the technology today compared to even when I first started farming, when I was got out of college, it's light years ahead, and everything is applied precisely. We got guidance on the tractors. I mean, you turn on the end of the field, push a button, the tractor drives straight to the other end. The chemicals don't overlap. We're probably saving 15% on overlap and things like that. Just a light bar system, which helps guide you down the field, costs nowadays a couple grand. When it first come out, it was like five. But it pays for itself, and we do that voluntarily. We don't need regulation to make you do something.
And you're on the Wicomico County Farm Bureau, right?
Yes. I'm on the Wicomico County Farm Bureau. I'm on the Ag Reconciliation Board. We've got a real strong Farm Bureau, really active. I'm not scared to voice our opinion. So people ask what you do in the wintertime. I said, well, I farm all summer, and depending on the governing body at the time, we might spend half your winter in Annapolis trying to testify on bills that are, in our opinion, my opinion personally, maybe trying to put me out of business or encumber me and cost me more money. So it's not like it's a, and we make a good living, but I don't, every time somebody adds a cost to it, you can only pass, like here at the market, you only pass so much along to the customer, because everybody's making a certain amount of money, they got a certain amount budgeted. If it gets too high, they quit buying it. So, and the Wicomico County also has a real strong young farmers group. Like we were saying earlier, there's probably 10 or 12 members in it. There probably ought to be 20, but it's like any kind of club or group. You got a core amount that do the work. But our, I do know, like our banquet is probably just about the largest in the state, and we have our county banquet. It's close to over 300 some people there. It's a testament to the County Farm Bureau of the good things they do, and then the people coming out to support it.
And how's the season going so far?
The season is a challenge. We're we're set up for dry. We got 550 acres. We can irrigate. We have irrigation on probably 500 of it. So with me, when it rains a lot, it's not good. We like hot and dry. This spring has been cool and wet. Just for example, our strawberries, normally we start picking the 20th of April. This year we started a few right at Mother's Day, around the 10th. So everything's been behind due to either rain, cloudy, or cool. Stuff is looking better, it's somewhat better. Our area, apparently, I was talking to our Secretary of Ag. He was here this week filming a commercial for the Watermelon Association. And he said our area is probably the worst in the state. The whole state's had good rains. They have a lot of good crops. They'll probably be a top yield. But right in this area, it's just been we got hammered early. Instead of getting an inch of rain, you get 4 inches. And like in June, some of my friends had over 20 inches of rain. In Maryland, I think the average is right 46 for the year. So when you get half in the beginning, it's tough on vegetable crops because all that rain promotes disease, fungi, and that type of thing. They attack the plant. And they're made for hot, dry climate. And some of the low-lying areas, there's a lot of stuff that's drowned out. It's just not going to be there. Versus with me, when it's hot and dry, we turn on the irrigation. Everything is controlled. It's a perfect environment. Hot and dry, you don't have a lot of disease. You don't have to spray very much with fungicides and that type of thing. So you're spending money for diesel fuel, but it's making you money because we can grow a lot bigger crop with irrigation than we can depending on Mother Nature. But as far as the market, July has been a good month. June was about the same as last year. The spring was off because we have a local trade, but, you know, we're still dependent on the Ocean City Travelers. And if it's 60 in Northeast, there's not too many people going to the beach because I know this year the Spring Fest was way below normal attendance. And it's just because it's cold, raining. You might as well, people are not, they're holding on to their money some, so they're not going to, they'll just skip this weekend and say, well, maybe we'll go another weekend.
So do you have any future plans for Wright's Farm or Wright's Market, things that are on the horizon at all?
Future plans for the market are to kind of keep where we are now. My son's in college at NC State. He'll graduate next year. He's coming back to the farm. Here we'll probably add on, kind of keep tweaking the ag entertainment, the things in the fall, because that's a big hit in October. Our product line, I mean, there's not too many new vegetables or things coming out, but we rearranged the market this year. Like, we've been here 12 years, and we changed the whole layout, and our customers that come once a year or twice a year are the ones that come every week. They're like, whoa, 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 and they like it. You know, it just changes like that. As far as no big expansion on that end. We're going to expand the farm in to try to add some acres there because my son's coming back. I told him, you got to pay your way. The pie is so big, and his mother and I are eating it. And NC State tuition. I'm just getting ready to mail that off tomorrow. If he wants to come back, I'm glad. But he's got to make a living too, so we do have to expand some. And it'll be, anything we add will be irrigated. We don't do the dry land farming here is not for me. So, but as far as that, just keeping our customer service number one, keeping our customers happy and providing top products, that's the key. Consistent people like consistency. And they like customer service because that's not found very often.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.